The term home economics may conjure traumatic memories of lopsided hand-sewn pillows or sunken muffins. Your experiences may vary. But common conception obscures the story of the revolutionary science of better living. The field exploded opportunities for women in the 20th century by reducing domestic work and providing jobs as professors, engineers, chemists, and business people, and it has something to teach us today, according to our next guest. Danielle Drellinger is the author of the new book, The Secret History of Home Economics, How Trailblazing Women Harness the Power of Home and Change the Way We Live. She is a former New Orleans Times-Picayune education reporter and a Knight Wallace Journalism Fellow. She has written for the Boston Globe and worked at WGBH in Boston. Again, the name of the book is The Secret History of Home Economics, and we welcome Danielle Drellinger to the program this morning. Danielle, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Yes, it's a great pleasure to be here.
So what brought you to this fascinating subject?
Well, it's a funny kind of story because in retrospect, it seems really overdetermined. I mean, my mother double majored in home economics and journalism, and I don't think there's anybody who knows me who would be surprised that I landed on this subject. But I didn't know much about home economics coming into it. I'd been covering education for about 5 years. I hadn't heard anything about it whatsoever. But I was thinking about what topic I wanted to write a book about. I was applying for fellowships, and I wanted to write something about education and about history and about race, gender, and class. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, this should also have something to do with my interests. Like, writing a book is hard work, and it would be nice to have, you know, some extra level of personal involvement. And I love to cook. I knit. I'm very, you know, homey. And so I just put this all into my head and thought about it for a while. And I was like, oh, home economics, like the class that taught girls how to cook. This covers all the bases. And immediately I started wondering, why hasn't home economics come back? Like, shouldn't it be back by now? Look at all of the trends in our culture and our society, right? Pushing, you know, HGTV and the fears over adulting, and, you know, First Lady Michelle Obama's campaign for childhood nutrition and, you know, career technical education. And then I started doing research on the subject, and the first thing I learned was that one of the founders of home economics was the first woman to attend MIT. And that immediately just blew open everything that I knew about home ec, and I thought, oh, you know, this clearly, there is so much more here than the class that taught girls how to cook. And that, in fact, was absolutely the case.
So before we get into the history, what is the current state of home economics in America's schools?
Well, it's still here. I myself took home economics in the early 90s in middle school in New York State when it was still, in fact, mandatory. At last count, and the statistics on this are not very good, but last count, more than 3 million middle and high school students in public schools were taking home economics every year, in, like, any given year. The thing is that this field rebranded in the 90s, so they now call themselves Family and Consumer Sciences for high school and middle school. At colleges, they might be calling themselves Human Ecology or Human Development or Family Sciences. So these are terms, and then there's still, you know, 100 U.S. colleges and universities, to say nothing of, you know, places across the ponds that offer majors in home economics. So it's just that people aren't aware of it because the name has changed. So, you know, your high school class might be called something like Life and Career, right, and the visibility of home ec has really, is really gone.
It's interesting because as I was reading this book, I hearken back to when I was in school, and this is in the 80s, and we had, so it was basically broken up into three trimesters of, you mm-hmm. would have shop, art, and then home ec. And within that category of home ec, you'd have a few weeks of sewing, you'd have a few weeks of family matters, of dealing with checkbooks and the like, and then mm-hmm. cooking. And that was considered home ec at the time. And what always struck me was, well, it's just not very much of it, you know, and not,
yeah.
It wasn't, it was sort of mixed in with everything else. You would spend as much time on that as you would spend on learning how to, like, mold plastic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, I remember the molding plastic.
Made a lot of cheese cutters. I don't know about you, Danielle.
Yes.
Yeah. So was that typically the way it was for a long time?
That is how it was in the 80s and 90s, I would say, when it was still mandatory in a lot of places, but the offerings were decreasing. And actually, you know, the reason that you took home economics as well as shop, and same here, is Title IX of, you know, all things, the law that brought us collegiate women's basketball, also made it illegal to put girls in home ec and boys in shop. And so it's great, you know, that we got to take both, but it also meant at the same time, so the U.S. school system starting in the early 80s was starting to radically decrease the time that it spent on life and career preparation and increase the time spent on academics, or at least that was the pressure and the trend. So now you have, instead of, you know, where you would have one student taking home economics for an entire year or for multiple years, you're trying to fit a lot more topics into less space.
So when it comes to the history, and you say in the preface, everything you know about home economics is wrong. So where is the good, where's the good starting point? Where did you want to begin the story?
So I began the story, you know, the actual story goes back a little before, but I really think that, you know, Ellen Swallow Richards going to MIT is the starting point for changing everybody's mind and for, you know, turning home economics into what it can be at its best. So we think of home ec as the class that, you know, a class about keeping women barefoot and pregnant and in the kitchen. But the founders, who include Ellen Swallow Richards of Massachusetts, who went to MIT, and Margaret Murray Washington, who went to Fisk College, an African-American woman, who then ran home ec at Tuskegee. These women were interested in professionalizing the home and bringing science and deeper thinking into the home. So they turned the home into a place where women could, from which women could have careers. So they simultaneously brought science into the home to make keeping house more healthy and simpler and more efficient so that you would have time to do other things, which could include going to school or doing paid work. And simultaneously, they turned the home into a range of careers, all of which were considered acceptable for women. So that might be teaching and dressmaking and running a kitchen, running a hotel, taking care of children. And they saw this, I mean, and to be sure, there were always people the whole time arguing for home economics as repression, as, you know, Margaret Murray Washington had to face people who thought that she was training Black women to be maids when she thought that she was training them to be moral leaders and working people who could bring in money and raise their families in a, you know, productive and fulfilling manner. But the founders were really seeing home economics as a force for liberation and careers.
So as I sit in a studio in Albany, New York, I was surprised to read that Albany plays a pretty large role in this. And you write about a woman by the name of Annie Dewey and what she was able to do ultimately by forming a conference, the Lake Placid Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of this history?
Right. So Annie Dewey was a really complicated person who was foundational in home economics and also really problematic, as was her husband, Melville Dewey, founder of the Dewey Decimal System. The two of them co-founded the American Library Association. The Deweys founded a hotel resort at Lake Placid, and Melville Dewey was state librarian of New York at the time, and they were living in Albany. And Annie put together a conference there that was foundational in the consolidation of home economics. So it had been called domestic science, it had been called domestic economy. It was becoming more prevalent in schools. There were starting to be magazines and associations. But Annie and Ellen both thought that people didn't really have the right, like they were teaching kids how to embroider instead of how to sew garments. This, you know, things that were not useful instead of things that were productive. So she had this conference, and there were about a dozen people there, and they just codified home economics. They chose the name, they chose its focus, they said that they were going to have it enter universities where they could really get a foothold into training the next generation of teachers. And this became, I mean, this grew into the American Home Economics Association, which is still around today and really became the driving organization in the field. But there were also a bunch of problems with this. For one, the Lake Placid Resort was segregated. They would not allow Jews and they would not allow African Americans, which, you know, from the start, home economics, that association was excluding some pretty important people in the field. And they also, the Deweys, became interested in eugenics. So they themselves, you know, went on to go to conferences in Battle Creek, Michigan, run by the Kelloggs, about, you know, how to promulgate eugenics and how their part of home economics could be part of that. And this is, you know, this is, people actually know some of this about Melville Dewey because his wrongdoings, he was also a sexual harasser, have been known for a long time and have been, you know, highlighted in recent years with our greater focus on civil rights and sexual harassment. But yeah, it was quite, it's definitely important to know that, you know, women of color were always foundational to home economics, but at the same time, they were excluded.
So the next move from there, I mean, something did come out of that conference, and mm-hmm. there were other movements, and then it was, for want of a better word, it coagulated.
Yeah. Yeah, the term they would have liked was crystallized. There was someone who said that the whole state of affairs was they used this, you know, a science metaphor, right? It was a super saturated solution that needs only the tip of a needle to crystallize.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea here that home economics should be for boys as well as girls, and that fight I don't think it's unfair to say probably continues today.
Oh, absolutely, it continues. I'm really glad that you're bringing it up, because one of the points of knowledge that I went into this project with is knowing that, you know, all the studies and everybody's experience shows that the work of the home is still something that falls on women predominantly. And home economics, so it's interesting because home economics was about empowering women. But at the same time, when I read through the first, you know, few decades of material, up to World War II, certainly, they didn't think that there was anything inherently feminine, most of the home economists, about household labor. You would see a few, one or two women coming to conferences and arguing that, you know, this was a woman's proper domain, but mostly they were just really pragmatic. And they thought, well, it's women who are doing this work, and we want to empower women, but, you know, anybody can do the work of a home. Anyone can take care of children. Anyone can, you know, cook a good meal. But then, and they were interested in reaching boys, and they would attempt to reach boys. They would often write textbooks as if boys were also taking the class, which they basically weren't. And they would, you know, periodically have, I would read, you know, journal articles about, like, how can we get more boys to take this class? Mm. But at this, what happens then after World War II is when you start seeing material mostly produced by men and tied into a whole lot of other social forces, such as men coming back from the war and women being pushed out of the workplace to make way for them. That's when you start seeing a lot of glorification of the mother and, you know, the feminine powers of housework and this, like, seriously gendered view of whose job it is to take care of the house. And it's interesting because, you know, home economics classes and clubs are still majority female. They're not as, you know, they're not as bad as they were. The first male president of the high school group, then called the Future Homemakers of America, was in the 80s. So, you know, boys have been around in home economics for a long time now. And yes, our society has not fully caught up. But at the same time, when I talk to middle school boys who were taking home economics classes in our, you know, present day, I said to them, you know, this used to be a class just for girls. And they thought that was ridiculous. Mm. They said, well, why? Like, everybody needs to know how to do this stuff. That's so perhaps the youth are leading us.
Yes, a fascinating perspective. I have to say, in reading this book, and you've told us about a couple of these pioneers, but your cast of characters is amazing.
Yeah, thank you. I think so, too. I mean, people used home economics to create such amazing careers and amazing lives. Like, I write about, you know, a dietitian. She was a military dietitian who got a gig in the U.S. military hospital in the Philippines, which was considered this, like, cushy assignment. And then you have World War II. And she ended up, I mean, writing this. There was this amazing documentation about the, you know, they were bombed, they were shelled. She was trying to keep patients alive out in the jungle in, like, people who later, you know, what later became like the Long March to Bataan, and was then in a prisoner of war camp where she helped people literally survive when they weren't given sufficient rations. She helped coordinate gardens and cooking to see what would grow there and what they could use to supplement the diet that people were given. You have women who, you have the women who founded home economics at Cornell who were loving life partners. And this was in, you know, the 1910s and 1920s.
It's fascinating to me, too, and I'm wondering if how you feel about this, but I was overtaken. I mean, even the cover of the book sort of alludes to this, but there's a nostalgia that comes with home ec. And as I started reading the subject, I realized that I couldn't name you the art teacher I had in high school or middle school. I couldn't name you the shop. Well, okay. Couldn't name you the shop teacher because he lost his finger in class, and I'll never forget that because it was traumatic. But I remember all of my home ec teachers, and I have great fondness and love for them. I think that's interesting too, because they were people that were telling you stuff, at least in my perspective, that, you know, like you would come from algebra and say, I'm never going to use algebra. And then you would walk into home ec and say, oh, okay, this is cool. I could actually do something with this.
Yeah. And I think I've heard a lot the how do I put this? I have a two part response to that.
Yeah.
One is that the home is really important to people. Like, the home is important to everybody. It doesn't matter who you are. Everybody wants to have a home. And there is something really powerful about that, that, you know, people in home economics and not have mobilized really successfully to sell us things, to push us into certain life decisions, and also, you know, productively to get kids interested in, you know, mathematics. Like, I mean, it's much more fun to learn fractions, adjusting a recipe than it is to just sit there with a piece of paper or a computer screen. Yeah, and the other piece is, I guess, flows from that point, which is that the hands-on nature of home economics is something that kids really enjoy and that a lot of people I spoke to emphasized, is that it's this shop too, right? It's this multidisciplinary project, or it can be when it's done well, that, you know, both teaches you life skills and possibly career skills and can teach you simultaneously more important facts about the world. So maybe you're learning to sew on a button, and that's going to help you with your clothes, but you're hopefully, you know, in really, really good home economics classes, you're also learning about, like, why it is that we can buy a $5 t-shirt at Walmart, what's behind that, and, you know, the, you know, global politics of labor and the environment and so on. And hey, that's why it matters to sew your buttons on and not just go buy $10 pants all right. the time.
So let me ask you, after completing this quote unquote secret history, give me a sense of how you think of what the future of home economics should look like.
Well, I definitely think that it should be this more complex pursuit. You know, the strength of home economics has always been this combination macro and micro level focus, where you're learning how to sew on a button and you're also learning about the, you know, global labor environment of textile production. And you're also learning career skills as well. So, and when I thought about how can we justify having space in the curriculum for home economics, because lots and lots of people were telling me we should have home ec, kids need to learn this stuff. It really seems to me that that multi-focus, more complex kind of class, and, you know, brings in technology and science like the founders wanted, is what makes sense. Because, you know, I cover education. I'm went into this reporting from New Orleans on schools that just needed to get kids, like more kids reading at grade level. If you're going to have time in the classroom for home economics, it should be this more intellectually rigorous pursuit that's also, you know, hands-on. And, you know, I think we'll just have to see what happens with the people who make such decisions. I do think that people are really, really focused on home right now. I mean, we've had a pandemic. We've all been at home for a year. We're all thinking so much about household labor and what we have in our home and how food gets to our table. I mean, who would ever have thought that we would have supermarket shelves that weren't completely full? So I think this is, you know, an unexpectedly fortuitous time to be restarting the conversation about home economics.
Well, it's a fascinating subject in a beautifully written book. It's The Secret History of Home Economics, How Trailblazing Women Harnessed the Power of Home and Changed the Way We Live. It is published by Norton. Danielle Drellinger, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Yeah, great talking with you.
Again, the name of the book, The Secret History of Home Economics. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.